The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, October 12th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Indy Duttagupta, president and executive director of the Center for Law and Social Policy, on the child tax credit and other programs that could combat poverty in the United States. And later in the show, Dr. Danielle Carr, assistant professor at the Institute for Society and Genetics at UCLA, will be with us to talk about mental health as a political issue. Meanwhile, Biden has promised consequences for Saudi Arabia after they led OPEC's decision to slash oil production ahead of the midterms, just coincidentally, which would make it harder for countries to completely cut off Russian oil as well. But this is the guy that fist-bumped MBS after promising that Saudi Arabia would become a pariah state, so I'm not expecting that much. A U.S. district judge will rule today on the lawsuit brought by six GOP states in an effort to stop student debt cancellation. And the motion for a preliminary injunction will be heard by a Bush appointee. Judges matter. Union voting at an Albany Amazon warehouse begins today and extends through Monday. If successful, this would be the second Amazon warehouse unionized after JFK 8. The White House has weighed in on the leaked racist comments made by LA City Council members. Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre has called on all associated members to resign. Legal abortions restarted in Arizona this week and will be allowed to continue after an appeals court blocked the Civil War era abortion ban. That's the they're trying to put in place here, at least until mid-November. So, hey, if you need an abortion in Arizona, you can do it until that case is heard again in the middle of November. The Treasury Department is opening a probe into DeSantis's stunt with the Martha's Vineyard migrant flights. That's good. Israel and Lebanon have come to an agreement over a maritime border, one that has been long debated. This could be a way for Israel to export more oil as well, which is why the U.S. was a part of that brokerage. January 6th hearings resume tomorrow, and they plan to present new evidence showing newly obtained Secret Service records that reveal that Trump was repeatedly warned about violence increasing throughout the day, and he still just didn't yield. And lastly, fears of Russia using tactical nukes within Ukraine are growing. And I shudder at the thought. As Russian troops have surrounded and taken over the largest nuclear plant within Ukraine and in Europe. And a reminder that Ukraine dealt with Chernobyl in the 80s, so there's a long history of trauma for this kind of stuff within Ukraine. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is, as I am contractually obligated to say, it is hump day, folks. Sam will be joining us tomorrow and Friday from Las Vegas, from the Tort Conference that he's incredibly excited to attend. I have yet to hear from him, which probably means that he's having a pretty good time, which is great. Unfortunately, Matt Leck is still not feeling well. He is out today, so it is just myself and Bradley again at the helm in the studio today. I see you more than I see anybody in my life.
This is our show now. This is our office. We've changed the locks. We've
we're seizing the means of production.
We've signed over the lease to ourselves.
Yes.
But in all seriousness, Matt did tell us that he tested negative for COVID yesterday. So we are thinking of him and hoping he's feeling better. And hopefully he will be able to join us later in the week.
There's a lot going around right now. I mean, I was coughing up a storm on Friday. I think that's what it was. I could barely
get through the
show.
And Sam had a little
bit
of a cold. So, like, yeah. I think there's anecdotally.
I didn't have COVID either.
Right. So. There's some non-COVID maladies going around, you know, with flu season coming up. So, you know. Get your flu shot. Get your bivalent COVID boosters.
Right, right. I'm getting that next week. So both of those things at the same time. Pew. Pumped about that.
Pew, pew.
Pew, pew. Shot into my arm. I'm sure, like, any right-winger were to see that, they'd be like, this is why the left is so depraved.
This is what liberals want.
This is the future that liberals want. Honestly, we should just do ESVN right now.
Let's just do it. We're Brett Favre, right?
Yeah,
ladies and gentlemen.
You want to talk about? We could talk about the Giants for an hour, guys. But in all seriousness,
Giants cast
4-1, baby. And the Rangers played last night. But again, okay, where am I? I can't save it for ESVN
tomorrow.
On Thursday. So let's talk a bit about this. What Biden is Biden's posture towards Saudi Arabia here. So. Biden spoke with CNN's Jake Tapper yesterday, and Tapper asked him about his meeting with Saudi Arabian leadership a few months ago and how Biden fist bumped MBS after running on a promise that he would make Saudi Arabia a pariah state because of this kind of actions. And their murder of Jamal Khashoggi is nothing new in terms of how they treat political dissidents and how they clamp down on freedom of the press within Saudi Arabia, let alone the terrorist acts against this very country that they have funded. And Mohammed bin Salman is feeling himself right now. He is trying to flip the power in the relationship, frankly, between the United States and Saudi Arabia, because he understands, like, they have not sufficiently gotten off the oil teat, and so I can do what I want here. And he sees himself in someone like Putin much more than he sees himself in someone like Biden. And so with that OPEC announcement where they're cutting oil production by 2 million barrels a day, forcing the rest of the globe to maybe reconsider Russian oil as opposed to going to, you know, the other non-tyrannical, squeaky clean sources of Saudi Arabia and other countries within OPEC. But regardless, it kind of takes some of the pressure off of the situation for Vladimir Putin. So that's why it's perceived as beneficial for him. And that's the case, right? So it's a thumb in Biden's eye, so to speak, even if I'm butchering that phrase, in a variety of different ways. And so Tapper asked him about this on CNN, and here's what Biden had to say.
Let's turn to Saudi Arabia. Some of your Democratic allies on Capitol Hill are afraid that the U.S. got played when you went to Saudi Arabia and fist bumped with the Crown Prince, because now, obviously, a few months later, Saudi-backed OPEC is slashing oil production in partnership with Russia. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Menendez, just called for a freeze on cooperation with Saudi Arabia, including most arms sales. Senator Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate, says the Saudis sided with Russia against the United States. Do you think it's time for the U.S. to rethink its relationship with Saudi Arabia?
Yes. And by the way, let's get straight why I went. I didn't go to one about oil. I went about making sure that we made sure that we weren't going to walk away from the Middle East and what was going on. And by the way, today I just got off the telephone with the president I got off the phone with the prime minister of Israel and the president of Lebanon. They've worked out a deal. They've been at war, declared war with one another for a long time. They've worked out a boundary relationship along in the Eastern Mediterranean for oil. And they're going to make an agreement that is historic. We also got overflights for Israeli planes over Saudi Arabia. We got movement in terms of how we would deal in the Middle East with aggression from Iran. But it wasn't, you know, there were eight other parties there. It wasn't about oil.
Okay, but you
but,
would.
But we should, and I am, in the process when the this House and Senate gets back, there's going to be some consequences for what they've done with Russia.
What kind of consequences? Menendez says suspend all arms sales. Is that something you'd consider?
I'm not going to get into what I'd consider and what I have in mind, but there will be consequences.
It's hard for me to believe that. Oh, hello, ad.
Sorry.
It's fine. That autoplay just kills you. Kills me too. But it's hard to believe given how he responded to the rise in gas prices that happened over the summer and how he essentially went crawling to Mohammed bin Salman and fist bumped him, gave him the PR that he needed. And what do you know? Gas prices, and part of it was just the inflation had essentially peaked and they began to decrease. But there's no doubt that OPEC engages in severe price fixing. I mean, you read some of their reasoning about why they're slashing production by 2 million barrels. And it's just because, well, prices could get too low, dangerously low. What does that mean? What it means is we're not able to price gouge enough to keep the kingpins at the top of the oil and gas industry here in the Middle East and in other areas of the world sufficiently fat off of the off of oil and making them as wealthy as possible. And the reality is that these guys are just they're pigs and shit, for lack of a better word. They have a ton of money, and so for someone like Mohammed bin Salman, this is just a game to him. It's political gamesmanship. He's trying to Bigfoot Joe Biden, and there are some ways where Biden could actually make him feel the pain, but Biden's a little too terrified that ahead of an election, gas prices are going to go up to this degree. But Responsible Statecraft, and I should say they're having an event on Friday to discuss this very topic. Dr. Anel Shaleen, friend of the show, is going to be speaking with Ro Khanna about this. But, you know, one, Bob Menendez has already said that we should freeze cooperation with Saudi Arabia on weapon sales, which I think already should be happening because of what Saudi Arabia has done in terms of the genocide and the war crimes in Yemen. And Biden at the start of his presidency essentially said that he was going to halt offensive operations in Yemen. And that is not sufficient because we are still aiding and abetting war crimes in Yemen caused by Saudi Arabia, but they just categorize it as defensive operations. To actually hold them accountable, what we would have to do would be to freeze arms sales to them entirely. But that would risk jeopardizing the relationship entirely. And then, you know, we would not be in a good way in terms of our access to oil. But what Biden could do was be tough on this, weigh some of those options, and actually engage in them. Because right now, what he should be doing is getting out ahead of this and saying, well, this is why we need to immediately transition to clean green energy, because we should not be subject to the whims of an authoritarian baby like Mohammed bin Salman, who's trying to toy with Biden because he doesn't like him. You have to hold them accountable, even if it's momentarily painful, and you also have to use it as a big picture opportunity to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, both in terms of the reality of it and how you're framing it to the public. So that's definitely some of those concrete steps that Biden could take here. With that said, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to be joined by Indy Dutta Gupta, president and executive editor of the Center for Law and Social Policy. We are back, and we are joined now by Indy Delagupta, President and Executive Director of the Center for Law and Social Policy, here to discuss the child tax credit, other programs that could combat poverty in the United States. Indy, thanks so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it. Yes, so you know, you talk a bit about the work that you do at the Center for Law and Social Policy, and what drives some of your focus on combating poverty in the United States?
Policy is a national anti-poverty and racial equity focused organization. We've been around for 53 years, and we work on a wide range of issues, working toward eliminating poverty and racial disparities, especially when it comes to economic security and opportunity in the United States. And child poverty, in particular, is quite clearly just a choice for policymakers. In that sense, we know how to reduce child poverty. We can do a lot to even come close to or end child poverty. We demonstrated some of it in the pandemic, the ongoing pandemic, and CLASP is committed to continue to advance the policies that we know work to reduce child poverty.
Well, one of the policies that we know worked for a fact and was essentially torpedoed by some of the conservative Democrats in the Senate, particularly Joe Manchin, in the negotiation over Build Back Better, which ended up becoming the IRA, is the child tax credit. Talk a bit about some of the data that you guys have collected about how effective the child tax credit was at that very thing, combating poverty and for children and for people generally in the U.S.
Yeah, that's right, Emma. The child tax credit was the centerpiece of an effort to shrink poverty during the pandemic. And essentially what happened in the American Rescue Plan is we enhanced an existing tax credit for families with children. From July to December 2021, we provided monthly payments for many eligible families of $250 for each child or $300 for children under age six. This reached almost 90% of children in the United States, these monthly payments, which we had never done before. And it turns out that it kept a few million children out of poverty. And lowered child poverty really drove it down to levels we've never seen in this country. It also reduced racial disparities, though those persisted when it comes to child poverty. We then allowed people to get the other half of the child tax credit for which they're eligible when filing for taxes this year. Unfortunately, we appear to have been about one vote short in the United States Senate of making permanent this extraordinary policy.
Do you feel that potentially there's a path forward for the child tax credit if the Democrats are to, say, gain a seat or two in the Senate?
Absolutely, Emma. First of all, I think there's a path forward right now in the lame duck session. There is this typical need at the end of the year to extend certain business tax provisions that are almost entirely essentially some tax-based subsidy for certain businesses and business activities. And for the first time, we've seen some folks in the Senate, Sherrod Brown in particular, a Democrat from Ohio, sort of put his foot down and say, I'm not going to vote for these business provisions unless I get the provision for kids and families with kids, this enhanced child tax credit. Look, I think there's some meaningful chance, even in this lame duck session, but I think, Emma, you point out that there's likely a path forward if the 50th vote is a different senator than the current one for this particular conversation around the child tax credit. Now, I should note that there's interest in the child tax credit even among some Republicans. The problem is that the proposals typically make a lot of people who are very low income worse off. And what was so effective about this enhanced child tax credit was that, in fact, it said for the first time, we're going to treat kids who have who live in families with the lowest incomes on equal footing with kids who have families with more middle incomes.
The problem is that we really do have a disgusting culture in the United States that of conservatism and bootstraps mythology that even Joe Manchin bought into, where he said, well, these families are going to use the child tax credit on drugs. And that's just not, I mean, really just old school racist dog whistling, frankly, from the Reagan era. But I'm concerned that there are more Democrats quietly who feel the same way than we're being public about it. Joe Manchin's just the easy scapegoat for someone like Sinema and Mark Warner or whoever. They don't want to be in, Mark Warner in particular, doesn't want to be in the media saying these things, but they might feel that way behind the scenes.
Well, you know, unfortunately, we've learned, not that we needed this reminder, but from what happened with the LA City Council, that people have a lot of racist views and have a lot of views that are sort of incompatible with, I think, the country that we need to build and our children deserve. I would say that our own research documented exactly what people who have some expertise here knew, which is that families use this tax credit for bills, groceries, rent, even sort of enrichment items for their children. So we do know that, in fact, the money went to terrific use. But there is, Emma, as you said, a sort of paternalism mostly directed at families of color, families with low income, when, in fact, the truth is that everyone needs some basic foundation to access and take advantage of opportunity. And you mentioned the bootstraps metaphor, and I'll just note that we are constantly telling people with no bootstraps to pick themselves up by their own bootstraps. Metaphor has lots of problems, but fundamentally what the child tax credit did was create that basic foundation for people. We have lots of research suggesting that doing that needs to pay off in the long run. So say you only cared about the return on investment to society or the government, and you weren't worried about the moral concerns of allowing children to live with such low incomes as they often do in the United States. We're talking about returns that are like 9 to 1. So every dollar you spend on something like the enhanced child tax credit would give us returns of $9. I don't know any investor who would turn down such a risk-free investment.
And I mean, it also to have that money going directly back into the economy. You know, I'm on the left. I'm not as concerned about that. But from the perspectives of people who might be more to the right in the Democratic Party, it's why the stimulus checks were favorable to some, and that they were able to pass those as well, was because this is going to be spent and recirculated back into the economy. So I just don't see any downside. We could reduce poverty, and there's a way to make business owners and trade groups or whatever very happy with this kind of program.
And no discernible harm to among the parents. Lots of reason to believe that the kids will earn more and have higher employment rates when they're older, when they get these transfers. At the end of the day, we need to start thinking about a basic income the same way we think about a basic education. Both are essential for families to be able to ultimately contribute as much to society and take care of themselves. And, you know, the final thing I would just note on this front, Emma, is yes, the money gets spent. Yes, it gets recirculated. But also, it's actually sort of a pretty modest amount on the scale of the overall sort of American Rescue Plan or Build Back Better or even what the inflation was. So there's good reason to believe that it would not have contributed very much to increases overall. And if we could make a policy like this permanent, then the economy would adapt and adjust and make sure that we are able to help families meet their basic needs without worrying about inflation. In some ways, doing it sort of as a one-off is particularly challenging and costly because the economy can't really fully adapt in a permanent way. So, for example, if people are buying more groceries or people are going to buy more enrichment toys, activities, games for their kids, it would be much better if that was happening on an ongoing permanent basis rather than as a one-off, because then the companies that produce these goods and services can adjust and produce them in ways that keep prices down.
So can you now turn to talk about some of the proposals that you have to make SNAP better, more anti-racist, more community-driven? I read a bit about this on your website, but I'm wondering if you could expand for our audience.
Sure, that's a great question. So a lot of people see a program like SNAP, and they might see it as sort of race neutral. SNAP is our nation's sort of front line of defense against hunger. It provides people near cash, so restricted, not quite cash, benefits typically on debit cards that can typically only be used for some specific set of groceries. So, for example, it's quite rare one has to get an exception to buy prepared food. Typically, folks who experience homelessness might get that exception. But by and large, it's used for groceries. And the program itself has a lot of provisions and specific requirements, including in particular some work-related requirements for people who are called able-bodied adults without dependents, who, by the way, might still be parents in some cases, but they may be non-custodial parents still contributing to raising their children. And one of the things we did is we sort of looked at the program, how the program is shaped, and tried to identify what the program could do to push back more against systemic racism. And again, Emma, you hit the nail on the head earlier, but a lot of people may not realize that these so-called work requirements were very extremely motivated in many ways by racism. It's well documented in the literature and news coverage, beyond dog whistles sometimes. I mean, sometimes they're just, you know, very blunt and direct. And in fact, these provisions like this work requirement or work reporting requirement in SNAP is a great example of one where it disproportionately harms people living in areas with high unemployment, and those areas often are disproportionately where people of color, especially Black Americans, live. You know, Black Americans routinely face recession-like conditions when the economy is far from a recession. They face double the unemployment rates in many cases as they do right now. So we have a number of recommendations about process and policies to ensure that a program like SNAP can actually help us build a more equitable society, which I think in turn will strengthen the economy and our democracy.
Work requirements for SNAP benefits are so counterintuitive. It is the opposite of what a social program should provide. When you're perhaps you've lost your job and you need SNAP, that's exactly when you should be using it. I mean, it is the paternalism, as you said earlier, is so disgusting to me. That's really just the heart of what probably gets me most fired up about it, honestly.
Yeah, that makes sense. We don't trust people. If you truly believe in freedom, as some people claim they do, and I certainly do, you actually need to give people this basic foundation, help support them in it. And you'll find actually that overwhelmingly people want to work. They may have caregiving responsibilities that make that impossible. They may be escaping domestic violence or stalking or intimate partner violence that makes it impossible in that moment. They may be struggling with untreated mental illness that makes it impossible in that moment. They may just live in an area with very few opportunities in that moment. So you can go on and on. What we have done, rather than sort of respect and appreciate that people are trying to do the best for themselves and their family, we have decided to say that we're going to put on these onerous requirements that often, by the way, are very costly to administer. As you said, I think can be quite counterproductive if you really cared about people prospering.
So, Indy, can you tell us how people can support the Center for Law and Social Policy and some of what the work that you're doing to combat poverty in the country?
Yeah, I like that opportunity. Folks can go to CLASP.org, CLASP.org. We are mostly funded by foundations. We work closely with our peers and other stakeholders to influence public policy at all levels, with some focus on the federal level. Yes, that includes Congress, but also the executive branch. That may be particularly important after the midterms. We also really have worked hard to engage people with current and recent lived experience to affect our policies, our policy recommendations. And we have a great team of folks with expertise here who understand a lot of the intricacies of these policies and the opportunities to change them to make them more equitable, or I think ultimately to help ensure that our social protection system, which is what I like to think of it as, also promotes opportunity and treats people with dignity and respect.
Well, can't thank you enough for your time today. Indy Dutta-Gupta, President and Executive Director of the Center for Law and Social Policy, as he just laid out right there. You can check out the website, and we'll put that in the podcast and YouTube descriptions for the show. Thank you so much, Indy. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you for drawing attention to these issues, Emma.
Of course. Well, with that said, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to be joined by Dr. Daniel Carr to talk about the politics surrounding mental health in this country. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined by Dr. Daniel Carr, assistant professor at the Institute for Society and Genetics at UCLA, who wrote an essay in the New York Times, Mental Health is Political. Daniel, thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So mental health is political. Now, you know, you asked the question in the piece, are we really in a mental health crisis? And for a lot of people, they'd be like, of course, right? My mental health is suffering right now. But you use the term medicalization of mental health. There is a lack of kind of maybe intersectionality and political understanding of mental health in this country that leaves a ton of gaps in our understanding. Just talk a bit about the biggest picture part of your idea about this, and then we can zoom in more on some specifics.
Yeah, definitely. So I think the underlying or overarching point of the piece is that a crisis that affects mental health is not the same thing exactly as a crisis of mental health. And what I mean by that is certainly not the position that mental illness is fake, or even that mental illness is non-biological, but that when we are thinking about what kind of a problem it is and what forms of causality are at work here, there's a difference between saying everyone just weirdly happens to have the same biomedical disease on an individual level and saying that there are structural systems in place that are producing these biological conditions that correspond to, you know, deteriorating mental health states.
Right. And so for me, it's reflective of an atomization of our healthcare system that we're, especially in the United States, designed to treat our healthcare on an individual basis. It's also a function of capitalism as well, where our healthcare is costly, sometimes is stress-inducing, and when you're dealing with healthcare around stress, you know, it's a bit of a cycle.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely that you see this in all kinds of ways. Medicalization, of course, does not only happen with mental illness, but you see this in like a million different ways where there's a sort of rhetorical trick that happens where the problem is reduced to the level of a single individual, a single individual's biology. And that's a much easier problem and a more profitable problem to fix than looking systemically. So for instance, I think diabetes, specifically type 2 diabetes is a great example where, you know, everyone thinks that we should reduce the rate of diabetes in this country. And of course, the reason why the rate of diabetes is so high in the U.S. as compared to, you know, comparable like Western Europe or whatever, is that there are infrastructural changes that would have to be made in order to address population levels of diabetes, right? And so I think that there's also something going on here, though, with the for-profit model of medical care as it operates in this country. I mean, capitalism is, and profit generation is baked into not just what gets framed as a medical problem, but the medical system itself. And so, you know, this makes a difference when we're talking about proposed cures. If we are having a mental health crisis in the way that it's, you know, often being discussed, then the solutions will look like, for instance, the booming market in telepsychiatry. Think about like BetterHelp, Cerebral, Done. The sort of, and, you know, we're all kind of getting these ads on our Instagram and TikTok and whatever that are trying to sell us on the idea that yet another round of profit generation through these startups that are doing things like slinging medications, psychoactive medications, addictive medications with, you know, very little accountability into what is, and what I argue is a social crisis that is having medical effects.
So can you talk about can you expand on the better help and kind of explosion of these kinds of apps and quick fixes for mental health that is, I would imagine, quite profitable for some of these startups. But does this have the same level of oversight that, say, traditional doctor-patient relationships have? Like, how have they been able to exploit this as a marketplace? Because it seems quite dicey.
Well, I'm glad to have the chance to talk about this because I think a lot of people don't realize this is happening. There was some coverage of Cerebral specifically by the Wall Street Journal, and I want to say there was an investigative report by Bloomberg, but it didn't get as much of a press cycle as I thought that it would. And of course, Cerebral is not the only company doing this. They were just the most egregious. So one of the things that happened during COVID, of course, there had already been telepsychiatry, but the kind of sea change in the market had not yet happened. During COVID, the rule mandating that you have to see your provider in person at least once in order to get the prescription for Schedule 2 medication, so we're talking Adderall, we're talking a bunch of controlled substances, right? That rule was lifted for obvious reasons, but this is why there was suddenly this kind of, we were all getting ads that were like, do you want Adderall? You can basically have some. Right, like on Instagram. And of course, these are extremely profitable. These are also, it's like not totally clear what forms of data these apps are collecting on us. So for instance, BetterHelp is currently, you know, there's a class action lawsuit against BetterHelp because the very poor privacy protections that were in place for what is, you know, an important medical encounter. And so, There's a movement right now, as you can imagine, from these companies to lobby, for instance, to keep the rules that were instated for COVID in place because a great deal of the profit model depends on those loopholes. I think people should think very seriously about that. But so that's wrong, right? We know that's wrong. But in another sense, and maybe even a more global sense, and this is not to indict any of the very hardworking and well-meaning and often heroic medical providers who are working on these platforms, albeit in an increasingly kind of gig economy model, which results in, you know, degradations in quality of care. This is not to indict them at all, but just to say it's not totally clear that this is the type of thing that is going to really make a serious difference with population levels of mental and emotional distress.
And, you know, what you brought up the pandemic, it really is striking how in the United States, this is a bit of a tangent, but our level of vaccine hesitancy was so much stronger than other countries that have a track record of providing socialized medicine and subsidized medicine from their government, where preventative care is encouraged because it's not, you know, going to cost you $1,000 if you're going to go see your doctor, or $5,000. There is much more of a holistic, and I don't use that in like the lavender oil sense, but much more of a holistic understanding of one's healthcare because of the profit motive at least much of the profit motive being stripped out from underneath that. And that could apply to the way that the U.S. relates to mental health care as well, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a good point I haven't heard made anywhere else, that in connection to vaccine hesitancy. I think that's very plausible and smart as a take. I think also, though, one of the things I'd like to encourage people to think about is, so it's not that I'm saying that we live in a society and therefore, you know, if we just like ended capitalism, that everyone's mental health would be better, right? Mm-hmm. This is kind of pie in the sky, too idealistic to really be useful for people who are, you know, experiencing very real suffering right now. But if we want to be serious about solutions and thinking about concrete possible solutions, we need to reframe the problem such that the solutions that occur to us are different solutions. So, you know, if you think about the amount, Biden's mental health care plan proposes to establish a series of like hundreds of behavioral health clinics. And, you know, it's not that I think that that's a bad idea. And it's not that I want to say there's some sort of scarce amount of government money that should go to this or that. But we also have to think like, okay, what about housing support? What about public transportation? What about things like, you know, addressing food insecurity for people? Which, and these are very real problems that impact mental health, right? And so what I am suggesting is that just because a problem manifests in the body does not mean that the solution to it needs to be medical care, much less medical care that is transacted through this highly individualistic, extremely for-profit way that American medicine works.
Yes, and that brings us right back to the thrust of your piece, which is something I couldn't agree with more, which is targeting the source of some of the generalized stress and thus anxiety that it has kind of ballooned in society, which is one that is created from insecurity of food, poverty, discrimination, capitalism more broadly, and then especially in the unfettered neoliberal model that our government has adopted. And I mean, just can you talk a bit about how alleviating those stressors of housing and those kinds of things and making people just actually able to live a comfortable life, especially when we're the wealthiest country on earth, could be perhaps the most efficient way to actually target mental health without atomizing it in particular, by atomizing ourselves and thus medicalizing it and making it distinctly medical.
Yeah, so I think this is a good time to reiterate that my position is not one of the anti-psychiatry movement that you may remember or hearing about from like the 1970s with like Thomas Zass, R.D. Lang, even Foucault to a certain extent, that held in some portions of the movement held that mental illness was completely fake, essentially. It was completely constructed, that there was no biological reality to these diseases. That's not what I'm saying. But when we talk about what kind of a disease is a mental illness, mental illnesses are categorized using a system called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or DSM, became prevalent with its third publication in 1980. And what you need to know about this is that there was a big fight going on between people who had a sort of psychoanalytic or a psychodynamic orientation, so like, you know, the therapists, and the psychiatrists who are trained as medical doctors. And the medical doctors, of course, want to reduce everything down to, like, this is the biological illness in the same way that breaking your leg is a biological illness, and we're going to find the causality that works through, like, neurotransmitters, right? And the psychodynamic people were not so hot on that idea. So what emerged from this power struggle was an agreement that, well, we're not going to really posit causality in these diseases. What we will say is that these symptoms tend to cluster together. And we're going to say, like, because these symptoms of, for instance, like depression, so like weight gain or loss, sleep loss, feelings of fatigue, feelings of hopelessness, whatever, we're going to just say that that's a disease. But there's actually no guarantee that at a neurobiological level or if you put someone in a scanner, or if you like take their, you know, take their blood or whatever, that there's a biological basis for the entity of depression. Now, I'm not saying that there's not, to this extent that any mental state corresponds to some sort of, you know, biological state. Of course, there's a correspondence. But we're not talking about the same kind of thing as tuberculosis, where there's a well-understood pathophysiology. In fact, if you talk to any leading neuroscientists in the field, they will tell you at a neurobiological level, at a biological, at the level of having figured out the biological basis for something, depression is not a meaningful concept. And same goes for anxiety. I mean, I'm talking about those two because those are the two most commonly diagnosed ones. And so when we're thinking about, like, what is the biology of these disease entities, well, these are not disease entities in the same way. And so, you know, the idea that you can just take a drug or that there's some sort of well-understood medical intervention that is going to just address this because it's a disease in the same way that tuberculosis or typhoid is a disease, this is just not scientifically true.
And it's a tricky kind of tightrope to walk because you don't want to speak to somebody and say, well, your depression is societally caused in particular, or it's not a disease for you, because it is. It's just, you know, in the same way that maybe that frankly poverty increases the likelihood of other diseases, in the same way that living in an area near a plant that is giving off some sort of emitting fumes that are toxic might increase the likelihood of some kind of disease, right? You can I think that there's a bit of a in the same way we've spoken about this on this program, where like economics should be seen as one of the branches of understanding society, much like sociology. You see them as a whole, but economists kind of feel that like they're scientists and their view is exactly the way things are. Putting mental health in and medicalizing it, and thus cutting it off from all of the other intersectional just realities of what goes into mental health, It's almost it's kind of in the same vein, right? Where this is scientific and unchallengeable, and then it there's no real end to in sight because you're not effectively combating any of the underlying problems.
Yeah, I think that the toxicity metaphor is a really good one or analogy there, because like, you know, if you think about like if there's a nuclear waste dump near your house, and then you see, of course, in your community, you're going to see elevated levels of cancer, right? It's not saying, it's certainly not accurate to say that cancer is not a biological problem. But if all that you do is treat the cancer without addressing the toxic waste dump, you're going to continue having cases of cancer. Now, the analogy breaks down there because our treatments for cancer that are available currently, given the sort of state of the art of medical care, are much more effective than the treatments that we have for mental illness. It is a fact that if you look at an aggregate at clinical trial data and and what are called meta-analyses, or basically analyzing many, many studies at once. Treatments like SSRIs for depression tend to not operate very much better than placebo. That's not to say that they don't help some people, and it's not to say that they don't address a sort of biological reality for many people. But the reason for this is that we're lumping too many things together under the same name.
Right. Like SSRIs work for people that it work for, but when you're having, when the umbrella is way too large, then how do you even know where the effectiveness lies, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other thing to be said here is that I'm also making a scientific argument here that's well supported by a great deal of the literature, which is that chronic stress has real biological effects. So for instance, chronic stress of the sort that you experience as a person of color, as a person who doesn't have very much money, right? As someone who's like, you know, so like we live in a society, right? Has chronic, so chronic stress elevates different chemicals in the body, different hormones that have downstream effects that influence the sort of the way that different parts of your brain talk to each other and the way that your body operates. And so I don't want to bore your viewers, but I would
no,
really
it's not boring. Please. You have no idea how dry we get on here. Please.
Okay. So for instance, Robert Sapolsky has a great book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers that kind of gives you a walkthrough of the connection between what's called the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, and different mental conditions. And this is happening at a biological level. So again, I think it's a false binary to say either mental illnesses are completely biological disease entities in the same way as tuberculosis, or they're completely caused by society and there's no biological reality. Well, there's a needle to be threaded here, right? Which is that society produces biological conditions. And I think for too long, you risked cancellation by people, you know, who very rightly were up in arms about the stigmatization of mental illness. But it's not saying that it's the individual's fault to say that it's not a biological disease entity in the same sense as typhoid. I think there's a third way to be staked out here, and that's what I'm trying to do.
It's funny you mentioned why zebras don't get ulcers, because my best friend is a psychologist and she has been recommending that book to me for a really, really long time. So now it's just gonna force me to have to read it now. But I guess that kind of brings us to the biggest picture element of it, which is just how to actually solve the mental health crisis. And I think on this show, we've spoken a lot about how moving towards a society where that is closer to a democratic socialist country, as where housing is guaranteed and where wages are increased and where healthcare is provided, that is the way forward. But for your prescribed solutions, is that what you see as something that probably is for lack of a better phrase, that's the prescription that is really necessary here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it has been, if I'm going to be very honest, it's been very funny to me to have published this piece and to, you know, hear all of the feedback from everyone. And most of the feedback, if you look, you know, at the comments on the Times piece, or, you know, my inbox was overflowing with psychiatrists who are like, this is very obvious. And people who work in the field will tell you that this is very obvious. And I think that it's certainly indicative of the state of affairs that publishing something that is completely obvious in the New York Times is remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the opinion section, we just like we need it, which is populated by Bret Stephens. This was a welcome change.
Yeah, exactly. It was just like, it's like compared to what, you know?
You're like, what the hell is this, right? In comparison, no one knows what to do with it. But anyway, really can't appreciate your time enough here. Thanks so much for coming on, Dr. Daniel Carr, assistant professor at the Institute for Society and Genetics at UCLA. And you can read her essay in the New York Times, Mental Health is Political, as a part of their broader series on this topic. Thank you so much for your time today, Daniel. Really appreciate the discussion.
Thanks so much.
And
this
enjoyed
was really
it.
Fun.
Yes, for sure. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick – well, no, actually, we're not. We're going to go into the fun half. Left Reckoning was on last night, but it was not on YouTube because they've been banned for talking about, I think – well, I don't want to get banned, so I'm not going to say. And you might – there he is. Jesus.
I'm taking over the show.
Hello.
I just wanted to say hi.
Full
hi, everyone.
Screen Bradley.
I just wanted to thank the chat. They were helping me a lot with audio issues today.
Nice.
With a lot of audio files in the chat. So thanks, guys. Appreciate
that.
Yeah, who
said that the show's just being run by two people today? It's
yeah,
us,
it's us.
Ex
Nilo on the IMs, the artist on the IMs, MIDI doctors, all my
homies.
Infantrymen. So yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, guys, for any and all help. Really appreciate it. But yeah, check out Left Reckoning. They I think released like a special episode explaining what happened. But you still can become a patron of their show. Support Matt, who, you know, for my money is one of the smartest people in our industry and one of the best voices out there. So Left Reckoning's a must listen. And for us, ESVN, you can check us out on youtube.com/ESVN show. We're gonna begin to migrate over there soon. I know we're on the MR channel for a while, and I think our flagship episode will stay there, but we might be moving OT over to youtube.com/ESVN show, where we give our picks. And this Thursday, we will be revealing what Bradley's and my punishment/prize will be, which we still haven't decided on. We have to read through the comments and make a decision. But if you go on last week's episode of ESVNOT, you can check out what you can write a comment and basically tell us what you think should be our punishment if we lose this bet throughout the year. Bradley and I are now tied, perfectly tied. We're 7-7-1, each of us. So it's kind of like a perfect opportunity to make a decision on what we're going to do, what our punishment will be.
If only the Lions did not get shut out by the Patriots in their second-string quarterback.
I would have taken the money. Yeah, that was a terrible bet, though.
The worst bet of the season.
No,
so
maybe me picking the Steelers to cover a 14-point
spread. Yeah, but like, why was I trusting the Lions and Dan Campbell to be able to like get one over on Bill Belichick is the thing.
Yeah, I just thought, like, when you made that bet, I was wondering, because the Lions run defense is so bad, and the Patriots have decided they're just going to be running the ball.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah,
but anyway, we'll be determining punishment/prize on ESPN, and we will also probably be talking about Davante Adams assaulting that camera person, what that means, how it's odd that he's a nice guy and did that, and
Brett Favre releasing his statement,
Brett Favre's statements, yeah, and more. Plus, next week we'll be having a guest talk about the upcoming NBA season. A very, very good guest that I think you guys are going to be really into. So youtube.com/ESVN show, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, rate us 5 stars, and listen to the show. I think we're doing a pretty damn good job. All right, we're going to head into the fun half now. 646-257-3920. We'll read your IMs and take your calls. See you there.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Boo.
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked. Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. Talking
oh,
for
wow.
a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
All right, me? You're safe?
Yes. show sound every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start off.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
folks. I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.